The key to this is around the Last Supper is one of the big things. And I was thinking about going out to eat. Go out to eat with a bunch of friends. It's a great opportunity to spend about 3 hours deciding where you're going to go. And then you wait about 2 hours for a table. And then when the bill comes, you spend another half hour doing high-level calculus, figuring out who's going to pay for the hors d'oeuvres. Carol and I had the opportunity to listen to Steve's sermon 2 weeks ago. We were in a hotel room in Calgary and were able to watch on the internet and thoroughly enjoyed it. And he taught about some of this lesson. I think one of the main things I got out of what he was presenting was about knowing who Jesus is, knowing him, and representing him, how to show Jesus to the people around you. So there was a lot in that that ties to this, I believe. Once again, we're in Jesus' last week. It's a very busy week, and that's what we're starting the Tuesday of that week. And the Feast of the Passover is coming up at the end of the week. Jesus is out in Bethany, which is about 2 miles out of Jerusalem. And I got a little map further down in the notes showing that. But Jesus has to go to Jerusalem for the Passover. That was specified back in Deuteronomy. You may not offer the Passover sacrifice within any of your towns which the Lord your God gives you, but at the place which the Lord your God will choose to make his home, dwell in it. There you shall offer the Passover sacrifice in the evening at the going down of the sun at the time you came out of Egypt. Now, the Passover was a big deal, still is. One of the commentators said it was probably second only to the Feast of the Tabernacles, which celebrated the tent that was used in the desert. It was to commemorate that, and the fact that they had to use a tent because they were wandering through the desert. They had to have a portable tabernacle, that's what it was. But it's usually celebrated in the autumn with the harvest. And the Jews are supposed to try to have at least one Passover, celebrate one Passover in their lifetime in Jerusalem, if you possibly can do it. That's one of the things they try to do. It was interesting that Nero, in 65 AD, which is in the time of some of the apostles still being alive, Nero thought that the Jewish faith was no big deal. He probably could just wipe it out. Well, one of his counselors said, why don't we try to make an estimate? Why don't we count how many lambs they sacrifice for their Passover? And so they counted them. And they came up with a number of about 265,000 lambs sacrificed for Passover. And each of those lambs is supposed to feed at least 10 people. So 10 times 265,000 convinced Nero that it was not a little deal. And he decided not to try to wipe them out that way. He did a lot of other ugly things to him, but that was an interesting little tidbit I picked up. Anyway, all right, so Passover's coming. They know there's going to be a huge crowd trying to come into Jerusalem. Because there's a crowd, there's going to be possible violence, possible riots. So the Roman soldiers are out in force. They are everywhere to be seen to make sure that there's not going to be any problems in the crowd. So you got that going on. Because there's going to be a crowd, and because there's going to be a lot of soldiers, the chief priests and the scribes decided this is probably not a good time to go after Jesus. That there's liable to be some big problems, so we probably won't do that. Somebody's got Mark 14, 1 and 2.
Now the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were scheming to arrest Jesus secretly and kill him. But not during the festival, they said, or the people may riot.
Bingo. All right. So Jesus knows his time is about ended. Another story I got was there was a diplomat who was imprisoned in South America. And when he was finally released after some time, people said, what are you going to do now that you're free? He said, I want to enjoy a good meal. I want to read a good book. And I want to have conversations with good friends. Jesus seems to have done the same thing. He knows his time is limited. He wants to spend it with his friends. He goes to a party. He goes over to Simon, and Simon the leper. Now, as we know from our previous studies, lepers are not allowed in the city. They have to live outside in the tombs or some remote place like that. And certainly not to have guests come in and have supper with them in a house. So Simon must have been cured, known as a leper, but cured, and possibly one of the lepers that we've read about that Jesus cured earlier on. So Jesus goes to his house for supper. Somebody's got the next 3 through 9 verses.
And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves indignantly, why was this ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor. And they scolded her. But Jesus said, leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them. But you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly, I say to you, whenever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her.
Several things in here. One, nard was a very expensive perfume that came from India, from the banks of the Ganges River, apparently. And some people had it, and putting just a couple of drops on somebody's head was an honor to do that, to perfume the hair with just a couple of drops of it. She used a whole bottle. Which was something that surprised them. The word that they used about response of the people around being indignant, that word is the same word that was used to describe the apostles' feelings when they heard James and John asking for being on the right and left hand of Jesus. They were furious. That's how they were, just really mad. Who do you think the woman was?
I think she was Mary, a sister of Lazarus, I think.
Sister of Lazarus and Martha. That's what John put in his gospel. Who do you think probably stirred him up about wasting money that could have been gone to the poor?
The treasurer.
Huh?
The treasurer.
And he was?
Judas.
Judas, right. He carried the purse and was not known to be completely honest with it. So here's an opportunity. But apparently he stirred up others and got them all pretty mad about what was going on. In this, Jesus' response was, you will always have the poor with you. A lot of times that's misinterpreted, taken out of context, to mean you can't solve the problem of poverty. That it's, you're always going to have it. And the intent was not that. The intent was you will have future opportunities to help the poor, but this is the right thing to do now. That was his point when he was saying that. He also responded to their criticism of the wastefulness and said, this act was beautiful. It was not wasteful. This was an act of love, adoration, appreciation, which is another good reason that it would have been Mary for him, for her relationship with Jesus and what he'd done for her family with raising Lazarus and so forth. So it was all an act of love. All right, from the good side, we'll go over to the bad side. We'll talk about Judas, because we know from our prior Bible studies what went on with Judas. So let's get into a couple of things. First of all, his plan, and why you think he became a traitor. Why did he go against Jesus and what was going on? Part of it is probably a crook, but anyway, my good source here, the master of the New Testament, David McKenna, pointed out four different possibilities. The first was for the money, just greedy. I can get paid for information, I'll make some more money. And being a thief and high on money, that might have been it. Matthew, the book of Matthew attributes that. Possibly the embezzlement, that he was a crook and he took money out of that purse. And the third one was demon possession. Both Luke and John reported that he had the devil in his heart, that the devil got into his heart and directed him that way. And then the fourth one, the word he used was nationalism, but I think the better description to me is that he was trying to force Jesus to act. That Jesus kept being a nice, soft guy, and he wanted Jesus to declare himself to be the king and pick up a sword and lead an army, and it was time to show his stuff and his power. And I compared that also to his mother at the wedding of Cana, when she asked him to change water into wine, to fix the wine problem somehow, because he had the power. She wanted him to do something, you know, and that might have been Judas saying, come on, do something, you know, here's an opportunity, come out and do something. So that's a possibility as well. So somewhere in there, he was motivated. His plan was to give secret information about Jesus' whereabouts and his plans, so they could pick a place to grab him. And there's no indication in any of the Gospels that Judas had thought, what's going to happen next? I'll turn Jesus in, and the chief priests and scribes are going to go grab him, and then what? Really future beyond that. So that was the plan. What actually happened? Well, first he met secretly with the chief priest to describe his plan. He got paid for his information. He led the temple officers to Jesus, and we're going to go into that in a minute. Jesus did not resist. Judas realized he screwed up, and he despaired at this. He tried to give the money back, And then he went out and hung himself. So that was what happened as a result of Judas' plan. All right. We'll get back to the good stuff. The Last Supper. Several years ago, we had a setter supper here. I see several shaking their head.
Several.
It was educational. First time I'd ever participated in one. And we each had a setting, like you see in the picture, very similar to that. We had little cups of various herbs and foods, and each one was described to us along with the prayers that are traditional that are associated with them.
Were you here when the gentleman, who was that that led that up there?
We had the Jewish man that was a member of this church. Yeah. He sat there and he
talked about it.
That was in.
That's been a good. Yeah, that's
about 10 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was the two because they would go to here one Sunday and over there to the synagogue one week. They went back and forth. And I know one time.
I'm trying to remember what their name was, but I remember them. Yes.
Lewis was the last name. Lewis.
Lewis.
Yeah, I just don't remember either.
She was a golf instructor. Lewis. The wife was a golf instructor.
Yeah.
Yes.
I can't think of either name, but we knew both of them.
And they moved to Tennessee or someplace.
Yeah, they went to senior housing over there.
Yeah. That's
we
right.
Have all that stuff.
They used to sit down on the front row. It's about the second row back. That's right. Anyway, the various foods in here represented various parts of the history. The carpus was a green vegetable, typically parsley, symbolizing the initial flourishing of the Israelites in Egypt, because they did come in as a family. Some others came later, but then they multiplied so that there was a million people or so when they finally left 400 years later. Haraset is a sweet mixture of fruits, nuts, and wine, representing the mortar used by the Israelite slaves to build structures for Pharaoh. Maror, a bitter herb, often horseradish, symbolizing the bitterness of slavery that they endured. Hazaret, a second bitter herb, usually romaine lettuce, used in the haleo sandwich during the meal. Zeroah, a roasted shank bone, symbolizing the Passover sacrifice. This is usually lamb, but contemporary meals may use roasted chicken or beef. I think I had a chicken leg. Betza is a roasted egg representing mourning and the cycle of life. So each one had a particular meaning, and they would each be presented with their background. So you've got the disciples setting up this supper, and they were all jostling and elbowing and getting on the side of the table, and the waiter came over and said, "Would you guys like me to put some more chairs on the other side?" He said, no, we all need to be on this side to be in the painting.
Just a little Passover humor, right?
Let's pass over that little humor.
All right, the Paschal lamb was supposed to be sacrificed on the 14th day of Nisan, which was Thursday before Sabbath. And the feast of the meat, to eat the cooked meat, was the next day on the 15th. Why do you think Jesus was doing this a day early?
Because he knew what was going to happen.
You have any thoughts?
He knew what was going to happen.
That is definitely...
So he had it Thursday, so he was sacrificed on Friday.
Right. but he was supposed to eat the lamb on Friday.
He was the lamb.
Yeah.
They were participating of him.
Very good. Very good. So both of those are part of the discussion. Second piece of that is that the Passover was celebrated to represent and remember the Passover of the angel of death. Blood on the lintels of the door. That happened one night. That's the Passover. And they sacrificed lambs to put the blood on the door frames. So that was Thursday. Friday is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because that's the day they scurried out of Egypt and they didn't have time to bake leavened bread. So that's why they had the flat bread. And that was Friday. So in fact, having the Passover on Thursday night wasn't inordinate. And being ready for a flight out on Friday would have been correct. So he didn't really eat Passover early, apparently, according to the description.
But that would have been very difficult to see all of that during the day, because, you know, it was from 9 to 12, and then go home and have a sacrificial meal.
Yep.
But that's right. What all of them would have done in Jerusalem.
Yes, all of that would have been done in Jerusalem, that's correct. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was supposed to take place on Friday, actually goes for about a week. And during that time, they are supposed to eat unleavened bread, but they're also supposed to remove all leavening from the house, because leavening was a symbol of sin. And so it was a time of removing sin from the house, to think about that and be aware that you are removing sin from the house by doing it. Kind of like Lent, when you give up something and let you focus on your beliefs and what's going on. So that was something that was going on there. All right, so preparations for this dinner. Somebody's got Mark 14, 12 to 16.
I have that. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" So he sent two of his disciples, telling them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. Say to the owner of the home he enters, 'The teacher asks, where is my guest room, where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large upper room furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there.' The disciples left, went into the city, and found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover."
This is another instance, like the time he was entering Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, where he told the disciples what to expect and how to do it, but then let them take care of the details and do it. Frequently, he's leading the group, he's telling them where to go, he's setting things up. But in this case, he's telling his disciples what to do. Please go set this up. Here's what you're going to see. Here's what you're going to do. And one of the possibilities is that this was actually in the house of John Mark, because his mother's house was one of their headquarters when they were near Jerusalem. And it's very possible that, and they were apparently a fairly affluent family, so they might have had an upper room big enough to handle this. So that's a possibility. Nothing clear about that. Then the supper itself is in the next several verses. "And when it was evening, he came with the 12. And as they were at table eating, Jesus said, 'Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me.' They began to be sorrowful and to say to him one after another, 'Is it I?' He said to them, it is one of the 12. One who is dipping bread into the dish with me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would be better for that man if he had not been born. Matthew later added another verse. He said, Judas, who betrayed him, said, is it I, Master? And he said to him, you have said so. So Judas, in all of his deceit, was to say, you don't think it's me, do you? And he said, you named it. And I will add, I looked up a little bit about the 30 pieces of silver. Apparently, the bullion weight of those 30 pieces of silver, today's market would be a couple hundred dollars. But in Judas' time, that was several thousand dollars that he was getting paid by the chief priest. That's our equivalent. So it was a pretty hefty sum that he got paid. All right. The book of John added some more details. Somebody's got John 16, 12 to 14.
I have much more to say to you, more than you can now bear. But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth. He will not speak on his own. He will speak only what he hears, and he will tell you what is yet to come. He will glorify me because it is from me that he will receive what he will make known to you. All that belongs to the Father is mine. That is why I said the Spirit will receive from me what he will make known to you.
I added this piece in here because this, to me, is the part that makes it clear that there's a lot more going on in the spiritual world that Jesus knew about, but he said, I don't have time to explain it to you. You just won't comprehend what's going on. I can't tell you all. But that means that what we do have is sufficient. It's not everything. Therefore, to me, the Bible is not a complete revelation of everything in the spiritual world, but it is sufficient for the humans in this world. We'll know more later. We'll know a lot more later, but right now, it's a limited amount. That's what I got from that. Then, after this discussion and Judas left, Jesus was talking to the 12 and he said the word that we use today for the Lord's Supper. And as they were eating, he took bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them and said, take, this is my body. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them and they all drank of it. And he said to them, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. These are the things that Jesus used to provide a memorable action of the covenant he was making. He was making a promise that he will return. And that's what this is. And that's why we celebrate it even today. Then we get to Peter's denial. This is a famous part as well. Somebody's got Mark 14, 16 through 31.
26. When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. You will all fall away, Jesus told them, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Peter declared, even if all fall away, I will not. I tell you the truth, Jesus answered, today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times. But Peter insisted emphatically, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And all the others said the same.
They were all brash, full of vim and vinegar, ready to go out and fight. But when the time came, nobody stayed. Not just Peter, they all left. So we go to Gethsemane, and you got a little map here that shows you Bethany, Bethpage coming back on the Mount of Olives, and then down the slope towards the temple is the Garden of Gethsemane, where he went frequently to pray. In this case, he said, and they went to a place which is called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. And going on a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, which is an endearing term, comparable to our term of daddy, talking to God as daddy, father, all things are possible to you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what thou wilt. And he came and found them sleeping. Now this is almost like when they saw the transfiguration of Elijah and Moses. The guys were asleep, and then they woke up, this vision, you know, something. They're sleeping. At a time, a critical time, they're asleep. And he said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? And he called him Simon, not Peter the rock. Simon the human, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. He knows that the devil is nearby and just looking for an opportunity. Peter, wake up. Simon, wake up. And again, he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer. What can you say? He fell asleep. And he came a third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Then he becomes deterministic. He says, it's enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is coming. We're done. You've had your chance. All right, so we have the betrayal. Somebody has... Verses 43 to 52.
Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, Rabbi, and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Am I leading a rebellion, said Jesus, that you have gone out with a sword and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be followed. Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus when they seized him, but he fled naked, leaving his garment behind.
I had not remembered the part about somebody running away naked. But if you remember that this book was written by John Mark from the dictation of Peter, who would know that there was a linen cloth on a young man, on a man, and he ran away naked, if it wasn't John Mark himself? And the linen cloth was an expensive piece of garment, which is part of the reason I was saying that John Mark came from a fairly affluent family. So that would fit something. But who would have known if it wasn't John Mark himself adding his own comment that I was there and I ran away and I was naked when I went. All right, so Judas comes, he brings the chief priest and the scribe. He also has a crowd with clubs and swords. And it's possible that the chief priests were hoping to stir up a crowd, bring a bunch of people in here, start a ruckus, and then they've got a reason to arrest a whole bunch of them. But Judas steps in and says, this is the one person you need to arrest, and greets him with a kiss like, hey, brother, good to see you, and gives him a kiss. How deceitful. But it does stop the riot and makes the arrest of only one person. Now, Matthew embellished this just a little bit and said of the person who was standing by that it was one of Jesus' companions that struck the sword. Luke is the one who added that it was the right ear, and then John identified it as Peter who struck it, and it was Malchus who was the servant of the high priest. So each one added their own details to what was in the original version of Mark. The trial before the council.
Larry, before we go on, I'm just amazed at Jesus. He knows what's going to happen. He's in agony having prayed, and yet he is a little bit argumentative, but not, you know, he could have been defending himself and everything, yet he maintained his cool. He maintained authority, yet he didn't overstep the bound that the Father did. He just kept his cool and just, you know, was able to counter them with these little arguments. But his head was in the game. And yes. I was just amazed that,
yes,
you know,
that despite control, what was going on and what was coming up, that he was so cool and thoughtful. And he's challenged to put them down. He said, why are you doing this in the dark? I've been here the whole time. Why are you choosing now to arrest me? What happened? And why are you bringing all these swords and clubs and stuff like that? You think I don't have a sword with me. What's the deal here? You're exactly right. He was definitely into it. All right, so they haul him off. As they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes were assembled. And Peter had followed him at a distance, not close, he was at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priest and the whole council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witnesses against him, and their witness did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. Yet not even so did their testimony agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? Well, there really wasn't a charge in there. So Jesus didn't respond. He was silent, made no answer. And again, the high priest asked him, are you finally going to try to get him with a gotcha question? Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Now, it turns out it was not a crime to declare yourself to be a Messiah. A Messiah was a human leader, and anybody could claim that. There might not be one, but they could claim it. But you couldn't claim to be the Son of God. That was a problem. And that's what the chief priest was asking. This was Caiaphas. And Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his garments and said, why do we still need witnesses? couldn't get any witnesses. So let's convict him on that. You've heard his blasphemy. What's your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and cover his face and strike him and saying to him, prophesy. And the guards received him with blows. All right, summing out of this thing. First, the arrest was not legal because there were no charges given when they arrested him. The Sanhedrin was the group of high priests. They can't consider a capital case on a feast day. This is in a feast time, and they're not, this court is supposed to be adjourned during feast times. So that's another problem. This trial was at night. All trials were supposed to be in the daylight. The trial was at Caiaphas' house, not at the normal court, which is the chamber of hewn stone, which is near the temple. If you've been to Israel and been to Caiaphas' house, they have excavated the cisterns under his house where he held the rainwater for his supply. And it's reported that Jesus was held in a cistern. And we got to go down in one, got our pictures made in a cistern where Jesus might have been held during the night of this testimony. That's a moving experience. It's a huge cistern. They had false witnesses, people who lied about him, and they couldn't even get their stories straight. So that wasn't in there. And the only crime they came up with was that he claimed to be God's son. That was it. They taunted him, they beat him, beat his face to a pulp, and spit on him. Now, the Sanhedrin was supposed to wait 24 hours from a hearing to a sentencing. They did it immediately. That's another problem. But during this time, they could not kill him. They could not impose a death sentence without the Romans' approval. So he's got to take him to somebody in authority for Rome to approve a death sentence. So that's going to be our next chapter. All right, and then finally we get to Peter's denials. Somebody's got 66 through 72.
While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with the Nazarene Jesus," she said. But he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said, and went out into the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, "This fellow is one of them." Again, he denied it. After a little while, those standing near said to Peter, "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." He began to call down curses on himself. And he swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." Immediately, the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him. "Before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me three times." And he broke down and wept.
Think about Peter describing this incident to John Mark. I'll bet he cried as he talked about it, admitting his failure at that time, what he might have done different, what could have been, but what he didn't do, and he admitted it and got it written down. That was a phenomenal testimony that Peter would have added these details. I recapped the week because next week we're going to talk about the crucifixion, the end, the intermediate end to Jesus. And what I got out of this, a couple of things. One is, not just Peter, but all the disciples ran away. Are we any stronger today? Are you willing to stand up in times of adversity to admit and profess your faith, your belief? And as a result of this, Jesus did not give up on Peter. And fortunately, he won't give up on you. That's what I got. Any other comments? All right, let's circle up. We're running along. Heavenly Father, help us to be stronger witnesses for you, that we take a lesson from what the disciples did, but we also appreciate the promise you made in the Lord's Supper that you will return, and that we will remember that as we celebrate the Lord's Supper each time. Watch over us until we gather again in your name. Bless us and keep us safe. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen.
Amen.